From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, NATO leaders come together in the UK for a two-day meeting with dual international challenges dominating the agenda.
To the east, Russia is attacking Ukraine. To the southeast, we see the rise of a terrorist organisation, the so-called Islamic State.
We hear from an arms control expert on what strategy the NATO summit could produce to tackle the Islamic State spread. And we're in Moscow to find out what impact this latest wave of international condemnation is having on Russia and President Putin.
Russia's diplomatic message has continued, really, that it is playing the good guy here and that it is NATO and the US especially that are really doing all the damage in Eastern Europe.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Western leaders have accused Russia of destabilizing eastern Ukraine. Meeting at the NATO summit in Wales, they said they plan to increase pressure on Russia unless it backs down. NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen accused Moscow of attacking Ukraine. Here's our correspondent Ollie Barrett, who was covering the summit in the Welsh city of Newport.
Russia coming in for some very harsh criticism at NATO here in Newport in Wales. It's being accused of being a destabilizing influence in the east of Ukraine. The Russian insistence that it has not sent troops into Ukraine is simply not being taken seriously here. NATO continues to insist that Russia has hundreds of troops inside Ukraine at the moment. Petro Poroshenko, the Ukrainian president, is here as a show of support for Ukraine from NATO.
The European Central Bank has cut its benchmark interest rate in an effort to battle weak growth and dropping inflation in the eurozone. The ECB cut its key refinancing rate to 0.05%, a record low for the single currency's 15-year-old central bank. It also cut its deposit rate to negative 0.2%, which is meant to incentivize banks to lend instead of save. After the central bank's governing council meeting, President Mario Draghi also revealed the ECB will begin buying asset-backed securities or bundles of loans issued by banks to businesses and households as early as October. Our Europe correspondent Sandra Gatman says Thursday's announcement was unexpected.
The move really has come as a surprise, given only last June the ECB slashed its rates after months of pressure and became the first bank to introduce negative deposit rates, meaning banks had to pay interest to keep their money in Frankfurt instead of lending. So this round of rate cuts is a clear signal that dropping inflation in the eurozone is worrying, but equally important is that the ECB is sticking to its guns when Mario Draghi says he'll do whatever it takes to keep the euro afloat.
Iranian and American officials are meeting to discuss a stalled deal over Tehran's nuclear program. The two-day meeting in Geneva comes ahead of a new round of international talks. From Washington, here's Daniel Wrenches.
The meeting of senior officials comes only days after the U.S. penalized a number of Iranian and other foreign firms for violating sanctions aimed at pressuring the Iranian side. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says they run counter to the spirit of negotiations, but he says he's not pessimistic about the viability of the talks. A July deadline for a deal has been extended to November because of divergence on the agreed number of enrichment centrifuges Iran can still run in exchange for a lifting of sanctions. Talks with the negotiating group, which also includes Russia, China, France, Germany and Britain, will begin on the 18th of September.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A judge in New Orleans has ruled that BP was grossly negligent ahead of the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. The ruling could cost the company billions in fresh compensation payments, as our U.S. correspondent Simon Marks reports.
The Deepwater Horizon oil spill 3 years ago was the worst in U.S. history, and BP has already accepted criminal responsibility for it and paid more than $40 billion in fines and compensation. Now that figure could balloon after a judge in New Orleans found the company guilty of gross negligence and willful misconduct. That could leave BP open to another $18 billion in penalties, and subcontractors Transocean and Halliburton were also found negligent and face steep costs. BP says it strongly disagrees with the ruling and is launching an immediate appeal.
And the UN's children agency, UNICEF, says violence against children is the one common aspect of society. The agency has released its largest ever report documenting the shocking extent of physical, sexual, and mental abuse against young people. Nick Harper reports from the UN in New York.
The report's authors say that no country is immune from the scourge of violence against the very young. The report, called Hidden in Plain Sight, draws together data from 190 countries, arguing that too many people see violence as normal, and therefore it often goes unreported. The figures reveal one in five homicide victims are children, and that 6 in 10 kids are regularly subjected to physical violence. UNICEF says more funding is needed to deal with the problem and is urging for global social change.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Pull out of Ukraine and take the path to peace. The message to Russia from NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen speaking at the NATO summit in Wales, where member leaders have come together for 2 days of talks. The alliance says it plans to increase pressure on Russia unless it backs down over its involvement in the Ukraine conflict. Moscow denies the accusation. It is attacking East Ukraine. While that crisis has dominated the first day of the meeting, the alliance leaders are also expected to focus on the battle against Islamic State militants. Natalie Powell is at the NATO summit in Newport, Wales, and I began by asking her about those dual issues leading the agenda.
We've known that the conflict in eastern Ukraine would dominate talks over this two-day summit, but the growing threat in recent weeks from the Islamic State movement in Syria and Iraq has really brought this topic firmly now to the table here. Now, US President Barack Obama and the UK Prime Minister have said that they are committed to bringing down the IS movement following the videos posted online reportedly showing the killing of two US journalists at the hands of militants and a further threat to behead a British hostage. Both leaders say that they would not be cowed by barbaric killers and would not negotiate with terrorists. So this summit is taking place against a backdrop of international turmoil, both in Eastern Europe and in the Middle East.
So Natalie, world leaders said pressure on Russia would be increased if it didn't change course over Ukraine. Do we know what form this pressure could actually take?
Well, the leaders of the 28 NATO nations here at the summit have openly criticised Russia for its influence in destabilising eastern Ukraine. Now, the West believes that Moscow is supporting pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine, though Russia has always denied doing so. And despite Russia calling for a permanent ceasefire with Ukraine and setting up a seven-stage plan for it, which will be discussed in Minsk on Friday, NATO's Secretary General has said that he does not believe that Moscow is doing enough to remove its support of the separatists in eastern Ukraine. Now, in terms of putting more pressure on Russia, the European Union is expected to announce a new package of sanctions against Moscow on Friday. That's according to government sources. And we know that the UK Prime Minister David Cameron believes sanctions are working. But several experts that I've spoken to here at the summit in Wales say that sanctions are hurting Russia economically, but they're not doing anything to put an end to the military forces in eastern Ukraine. Now, interestingly, Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko was invited to the first day of the NATO summit, and we know that NATO has severed all ties with Russia. So that, again, is likely to send a strong message to Moscow about NATO's support for Ukraine, despite the fact that Ukraine is not a member of the alliance. And we also know that France has postponed the delivery of two warships to Russia, as it isn't satisfied with Russia's commitment to a ceasefire. Though we're not entirely sure how long that postponement is likely to last. So really what we're seeing is a number of things that NATO nations are doing to increase the pressure on Russia, but how effective they're going to be at putting an end to the crisis in Ukraine is really debatable.
And what about this IS threat? Is this summit expected to galvanise more of an international response to that situation in both Syria and Iraq?
Well, the summit has really shone the light on UK Prime Minister David Cameron, and there's no doubt that he's going to use that to his advantage in pushing his agenda on combating terrorist threats from the Islamic State movement. Now, the videos that we've seen released in recent weeks by IS reportedly showing the killing of two US journalists have sent shockwaves through Britain. The reason being is because the militant in the video seems to have a British accent. And this has really highlighted the growing problem of radicalisation in the UK. So it's a subject that is close to the Prime Minister's heart, and no doubt he will use that fact and the fact that he is hosting these 28 members of NATO here in the UK to his advantage when it comes to this subject.
And what about day two? Would it be more of the same for the alliance talks in Wales?
More of the same in terms of more talks, more meetings and more focus on IS and Russia, Ukraine, no doubt. But it will begin with a bit of razzmatazz. Delegates will be treated to a military aircraft flypast over the Celtic Manor Resort where the summit is taking place. And we'll have a summing up of the past 2 days, along with any communiques that come out, which will presumably pledge plans of action going forward on all of the topics that have been discussed over these 2 days of this summit.
FSN's Natalie Powell in Newport, Wales. Now, for more understanding on what an event like this summit encompasses, LBC's Lisa Aziz spoke to David Galbraith, a professor of international security, and arms control specialist Ted Say. She began by asking Professor Galbraith what he expects the alliance leaders to agree on.
Well, the leaders are going to be agreeing on any further action. I mean, by all means, we expect the United States to lead on military operations in Iraq. With the increased risk of military intervention in Syria as well, especially on the Israeli border, I think there are very serious issues of some kind of escalation across the region. And the United States and its allies, and most definitely through NATO, is going to be looking to limit the damage.
Do you think from the US angle that they'll be keen to show that they can't go on shouldering the work, if you like, as all these various conflicts go on around the world?
Absolutely. And if you look at the language of the United States leading up to the NATO summit, and even as the NATO summit is being planned out, there's a very clear signal that things are changing. The United States is changing its focus, is bringing about where it decides to use its forces and where it decides even to see threats and insecurity in the world is changing, and that's a very strong signal to the allies.
Do you think that the UK will be firmly going into this? David Cameron will be going in saying he's looking for certain collaborations which will be a top priority for him?
He will be looking for certain collaborations, and there's a very strong relationship between both the United States and French for the British Armed Forces. And so the question there is going to be what's likely to be the intensity of British involvement in Syria and Iraq, and still we see a reluctance, and this is because of the failed vote in the House of Commons on intervention in Syria before. And so the degree to which the British Armed Forces will be able to escalate their involvement is still under question.
Professor, good to talk to you this morning. Appreciate your time on a very important day. An awful lot of people, as we say, gathering in one place in Newport. Let's talk to Ted Say now. He's certainly got lots of experience of summits like this. Many calling NATO the toothless tiger, meanwhile. You know, these summits are all well and good, but really, what's the point?
Yes, indeed.
What is the point?
The point is there has to be some kind of mechanism to affirm consensus among 28 nations, which is never easy to achieve.
What tangible progress do you expect will actually be made from this summit, from your past experience?
I would say if not nil, then practically nil.
Goodness me.
No, I'm sorry, but I think that's a fair statement. I don't think there's really much of anything of real international import or use that those 28 countries can agree on this point.
And yet, this year, more than perhaps many other summits, there is so much going on in the world, so much conflict. These are very important leaders who will be wanting to deal with people like ISIL.
They'll be wanting to make bold statements that sound as though they're resolute. And if they're able to do that, then that's the most that NATO can achieve at the moment. Because if we look back at even fairly recent history, the refusal of NATO to go into Iraq with the U.S. in 2003 almost tore the alliance apart. And ever since then, NATO has been hugely, hugely reluctant to address anything really controversial around the North Atlantic Council table.
LBC's Lisa Aziz speaking to David Galbraith, a professor of international security, and arms control specialist Ted Say. Now, a new ceasefire plan over the unrest in East Ukraine could be imminent, with the Ukraine government and pro-Russian rebel representatives claiming a truce could come into effect on Friday. However, the agreement hinges on both sides committing to a peace plan to end the fighting, which has been ongoing since April. To find out how Russia has been responding to the latest wave of condemnation from NATO over the Kremlin's role in the Ukraine crisis, we spoke to FSN's Moscow correspondent Tom Barton.
Well, from what we've been hearing today and in previous weeks, Russia, in terms of the war of words and in terms of diplomatic language, is giving as good as it gets. We've heard a Russian general say that he wants to try and reintroduce a doctrine whereby Russia can, in certain circumstances, use a preemptive nuclear strike. And that is made even more potentially threatening by the added comments of that general, that he wants to update Russia's military doctrine to say that Russia's number one threat is the US and the North Atlantic bloc, as he put it. And that, add that also to Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov's statement today, saying things like that the US really just wanted to manipulate Ukraine and dictate its will to other countries, and that that would undermine efforts for peace. You can see how Russia's diplomatic message is continued, really, that it is playing the good guy here, and that it is NATO and the US especially that are really doing all the damage in Eastern Europe.
So what about the status then of a potential ceasefire? Rebel leaders have been quoted as saying that perhaps this could come in as early as Friday. Where does that stand?
Well, there's been a lot of to-ing and fro-ing when it comes to ceasefires. There is still fighting going on the ground in eastern Ukraine, as far as we can tell. There has been all sorts of announcements. We heard the to and fro the other day with an initial announcement that there had been an agreement on a permanent ceasefire, and then a retraction, a clarification from Vladimir Putin, Russian president's spokesman, saying that Russia had not agreed to a ceasefire because it was not a party of the conflict. And that is a continuation of Russia's continuous denial that it has troops on the ground in eastern Ukraine. It's a crucial point both for Russia, NATO, and those in eastern Ukraine. But then we also heard Ukraine's presidential press service saying that it was merely talks towards and progress towards a ceasefire. But we have heard similar noises coming out of Ukraine and Kiev today. To that end, we've heard Vladimir Putin saying that he hopes potentially by Friday there could be an agreement signed. And we've also heard from some of the rebels in eastern Ukraine on the ground saying that they may be prepared also to tell their troops to stop firing. But that is the central problem. Who exactly can they command? Who does Russia control? How many troops do the rebel commanders control? And indeed, does Ukraine have full control of its armed forces as well? The potential on the ground for there to be continued firing by some groups who don't like the conditions, that don't suit them individually, could see the whole thing unravel.
FSN's Moscow correspondent Tom Barton. This is FSN Reports. To coincide with the opening of the NATO talks, the Islamic State threat was addressed by President Obama and UK Prime Minister David Cameron in an article the two leaders wrote for the Times of London newspaper, in which they insist they will not be intimidated by the brutality and ideology of IS extremism. UK Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg believes the entire international community must recognise the real and immediate danger of this terrorist threat.
I think it would be a total disaster if this comes to be perceived as the West against the rest. And it is emphatically not the case that that is what it is. Let's remember, we are only acting, obviously we have a self-interest, we want to keep ourselves safe, but we are acting through the humanitarian aid that we've provided, the airstrikes that the US are conducting, in support of the legitimate government in Baghdad, the legitimate authorities in the Kurdish region, against a terrorist organization, which is literally carving out a new country across two other nations. And you speak to any country in that region. The King of Jordan was in Westminster in the House of Commons yesterday, saying, quite understandably, how much he passionately feels that it is the duty of his country to join in and in the region, mobilise a regional push against ISIL. And we are there to support, assist, participate in that. But let's absolutely get away from this idea that somehow we can fix this from Washington or we can fix this from the Ministry of Defence. This is, you're quite right, Sean, this is part of a much wider movement which has to be led first and foremost by the countries and legitimate authorities in the region. If the moment this collapses, or anyone allows this, wittingly or otherwise, to collapse into a perceived sort of West versus the Islamic world, I think we would then be drawn into a terrible downward spiral of violence, which would be very difficult to escape. You know, let's remember, there is a schism opening up, a very violent one, between these extremists, ISIL, who are perverting the religion of Islam, and the greatest offence, in my view, that they're causing is to other Muslims. And we must remember that. We are there, you know, we are fighting, we are alongside, we are side by side, we are arm in arm with the many, many millions of devout, law-abiding, peace-loving Muslims around the world who are more offended than anybody else by what ISIL stands for. And that is the prism through which we should see this, not a sort of, can Washington and London fix this from on high? And that is why, by the way, whilst I totally understand, completely, I feel it myself, can't we fix this? Can't we fix this by next Tuesday? We have to proceed in cooperation with countries in the region. We've obviously got to have discussions in the United Nations. You've got to build up a case. You've got to work out with other countries what you're going to do. And sometimes, I understand everyone's fear and impatience to have all of this fixed overnight. Sometimes, doing that in a way so that the push against ISIL, and we will all have to work together to push against ISIL, is successful. Sometimes doing that systematically, methodically, in the way that you suggest, is the best way forward.
UK Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg on LBC Radio. Finally tonight, FSN Spotlight. And with that, here's Simon Marks.
Today on FSN Spotlight, with President Obama at the NATO summit in Europe, we thought it was time to spend a few minutes visiting a country that has been expanding its ties with the alliance in recent months. Sweden has signalled that it will sign an agreement making it easier for NATO troops to operate on its territory, a move that analysts say has been hastened by Russia's territorial designs on Ukraine. Sweden is in the middle of an election campaign at the moment. Its centre-right government, in power since 2006, is trailing opposition parties of the left. And Richard Milne, the Baltic editor of the Financial Times, has been on the campaign trail.
Sweden's Prime Minister Fredrik Reinfeldt is on a desperate scramble for votes ahead of elections on September the 14th. His centre-right government is seeking an unprecedented third term, but trailing the left by somewhere between 7 and 10 percentage points. So why has he come to Vårgårda, a rural town of 5,000 inhabitants, to be interviewed by a priest? The move is particularly striking in Sweden, a place one churchgoer described to me as the most secular country in the world. But party leaders from across the board have been making the pilgrimage to Vårgårda and the Uniting Church in Sweden since 1968 to get their message across. Reinfeldt has taken the consensus-loving Swedes in a radically new direction. In his 8 years, private companies have taken over more and more public schools and hospitals, while numerous taxes have been cut. For this election, he stresses how Sweden has exited the financial crisis better than most European countries.
We have created more than 250,000 new jobs, which is an achievement if you compare with other countries. At the same time, you've seen a decrease in employment in Denmark, and it's actually no growth in employment in Finland. But Sweden is the odd one out, with stronger growth, stronger public finances, and also the growth when it comes to employment.
On stage at Vårgårda, Reinfeldt talks about immigration, foreign aid and unemployment benefit. He's interviewed by Britta Hermansson, a priest from Gothenburg, who's one of the few people to talk to all eight main party leaders in this campaign. She says thinking about Christian values is important, as many Swedes have lost their spirit of generosity.
I think in this secular world we lost some of that. We think about what can I get, how can I have a better life, how can I have a bigger flat, how can I have a nice car, how can I do that and that, I. And I think the church have to come out and say, how can I be a more generous person?
The Prime Minister shook up this election campaign by saying that Swedes should open their hearts to immigration. But he also warned the growing cost of welcoming refugees meant he'd make no more spending promises. That infuriated the left, but it also boosted the populist anti-immigration Sweden Democrats, a possible kingmaker for the next government. So does Reinfeldt regret saying it?
No, because I wasn't relating to any other party. I was relating to the situation in the world. This is the absolute neighbourhood of Europe, with a very worrying situation, with increasing security threats to Europe, and also in a way to Sweden, with new kinds of terrorism, failing states, a refugee situation which is probably the worst we have seen in 70 years. So I'm preparing the Swedish people to say, open your hearts, this is catastrophe in our time. We therefore have a very rapid increase in the Swedish population, which is not the case with all other European countries. And to my mind, that's a way of creating a strong society for tomorrow.
The crucial question is whether the left-wing parties led by the Social Democrats leader Stefan Löfven managed to convert their comfortable lead in the polls into a majority. If they don't and can only form a minority government, the door could be open for Reinfeldt to try to continue, especially if the polls continue to narrow.
Fredrik Reinfeldt has a reputation as one of Europe's most experienced politicians, and he spent much of the election campaign trying to persuade voters that he, rather than his rival Stefan Löfven, has the necessary statesman-like demeanour. But in this Nordic country renowned as a bastion of social democracy, he faces his toughest fight yet in gaining power. Richard Milne, Financial Times, Vårgårda.
And there's more coverage from Richard Milne in the Financial Times newspaper and online at ft.com. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to get in touch, you can email us, reports@featurestory.com, and you can follow us on Twitter. We're there, @featurestory. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside Rebecca Foster with The Bulletin. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.